right, we are here. Let me welcome to the show. He is, of course, the CEO of the Steve Fund. We're going to find out, who is Steve? Who is Steve? Let me welcome. It's an organization focused on supporting the mental health and emotional well-being of young people. Young people, they say, of color. I'm going to say black. Let me welcome the one and only David McGee to the Karen Hunter Show. Hello.
Hello, Karen. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming through. Brother, I appreciate you. I'm trying to open this up so I can get Smith. Send me the link again, because my Zoom is acting up, and I want to be able to cast eyes on Mr. David McGee. Before, as I'm waiting for Smith to shoot me the link, tell me, who is Steve? Who is Steve, and why does he have a fund?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, Karen, thank you so much for having me, and also thank you for the question. So the Steve Fund, I'll talk about the org at a high level, what I like to call the balcony, and then I'll come to the dance floor. It's the nation's leading organization focused on transforming educational, organizational, and workplace environments to enhance support for mental health and emotional well-being of young people of color. So we are an institution that focuses on the mental health and emotional well-being of young people of color. And Steve, the organization's namesake, was a phenomenal, beautiful, brilliant young man of color who struggled a bit in the mental health space transitioned essentially. So the organization and his family kind of stood this organization up to honor his legacy, for sure. To support other families that may have loved ones who are battling mental health, but then also just to change the narrative in the collective conversation around what might it mean to support the mental health and emotional well-being of young people of color.
Okay, so how did you, David McGee, get involved in this? And you are the CEO, but are you also the founder?
No, I am not the founder. It's interesting, right? Because, you know, I was inspired to join the Steve Fund because of his commitment to mental health and emotional well-being for young people of color. I'm a grant maker, right? So people often talk about, you know, I want to write a grant, I want to get some funding. I was on the other side of the table for about 10 years, actually writing the checks to support organizations and individuals across the country. And I reached a point, you know, having spent time in a nonprofit space, spent time in a federal government space, and then also in philanthropy, right, and grant making, you know, I'm on the second mountain, right? there's a book called The Second Mountain, and really looking at this portion of my life to really drive home some mission-driven work. It's fun giving away money, Karen. I'll tell you, like, that was probably the funnest thing.
I dream of that. You know, every time the lottery comes around, I don't play it, but I'm like, if I had $1 billion, you know, it's like Brewster's
Million. I didn't have a billion, but I did have grant making portfolios ranging from $17 million to about $30 million a year annually, right? And my job was to develop a strategy to give money away. So at any rate, I joined the Steve Fund as CEO, having spent time working for an ultra high net worth family in Seattle about 6 months ago, really to lead a cause, Karen, that I probably would say is the crisis of our time, right? Mm. The mental health and emotional well-being, and the Surgeon General said it as well, of our young people, and in the Steve Fund's case, young people of color.
There are people that hate people of color because it doesn't really talk to the issue. Black boys are, suicide rate among black boys in the United States of America is alarmingly high. I think it is 3 times higher than it's ever been. And that's a crisis. Something is happening in this country, and black boys are suffering at an alarming rate. So I want to call a thing a thing.
It's not
black boys of color, not boys of color, black boys are in crisis. What do you know about this, David McGee? And then what does the Steve Fund do to address it?
Yeah, so I'm glad you called it, right? Like, coming up, you call a spade, right?
Before you say it, because I'm sorry. I'm just so tired that we are in these spaces where in order to get money, you have to word things a certain kind of way so that people feel included and they're not left out. You know, it's like, we can't even tell the truth to go get money. Y'all, we can't, you know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, well, you're not including, but then we can't have diversity and inclusion. That's a problem too. We have painted ourselves in all these little boxes when if we would just tell the truth about a thing and people really cared, and it's not just about checking a box or writing a check just to say you wrote a check. that covers all of these things. If you really cared, we wouldn't have to jump through these hoops to go get money. But I digress. Go ahead. Tell me.
Yeah, no. This is you speak of my language. So, I mean, the reality of it is, right? So people of color, black people, like, and how you've laid out, face unique stressors such as systemic racism. And these factors are prevalent amongst the black population and amongst other populations, right? Like, I mean, it's a real thing. Like, as a black man, right? As a black father, as a black husband, and as a black man that's had to navigate society, there's like a dial, if you will, that I use, right? Like, if I park my car and I walk into Panera, like, I adjust the dial, right? Like, and if, you know, and if I'm going to a gas station in Detroit, as I often do, right? I adjust the dial, right? So I do think that there are a set of unique experiences that Black people have, for sure. And then there's a set of unique experiences, dare I say it, that people of color have in the environments in which they occupy, right? So we talk about our workplace environments. We talk about our higher education environments, right? Like, just their experience is different. So the C Fund is committed to addressing the nuanced challenges like that you just laid out, working to dismantle the barriers and create culturally sensitive material. So when my young black boy, who's 8 years old now, right, when he walks into an environment, whether it's at school, and if we get to it, I have a very interesting story to tell you about my 8-year-old in Black History Month. But when he walks into that environment is prepared to receive him, right? And they're prepared to prepare him and educate him, right? So the STEE Fund focuses high level on three things: transforming these environments that our young people find themselves in, sharing direct resources, right, to children and families. Because it's one thing for a young person to experience a mental health challenge. It's another thing to make sure that we support those who are supporting that young person, right? Those caregivers. What does mom and dad and aunts and uncles do, right? They aren't equipped all of the time. And then the last thing is to really shape the field, which is changing the narrative and having these conversations with people such as yourself.
All right. You have an 8-year-old. We're talking with David McGee. David McGee is the CEO of the STEE Fund, stevefund.org, or the STEE Fund on Twitter, stevefund.org. And I want to refine what I said about black boys. It's actually black children ages 5 to 12. Black children ages 5 to 12 are twice as likely to die by suicide as their white peers. And black teen suicide is up 78%. This is from a study from last year. What do we do? So you have an 8-year-old. There are people listening right now that have children between the ages of 5 and 12. They're depressed. They feel lonely. They feel disconnected. They're scared and anxious. The world is crazy. Give them some action items directly from what you know that can help these characters. Again, none of us are really equipped. I don't know what I would do if a young person came to me and said they were contemplating. And they don't tell you 5 to 12. They're not telling you that they're contemplating. So are there signs? And then what do we do?
Yeah. So it's interesting that you raised that, right? Because when we look at the data, and I'm so glad you started with that, we understand that, to your point, suicide is the leading cause of death for Asian Americans as well. Black teenagers are 1.5 times more likely to attempt suicide, right? Like, when you actually sit with that, you understand, and we all understand, that there's a higher risk of mental health challenges and those who are less likely to receive mental health care, right? So one of the things that I would encourage parents and the families, and then also respectfully communities, to do first and foremost is to, like, listen, right? And have that opportunity to look for those look fors, right? Oftentimes in the black house is, you know, what happens in this house stays in this house, right? But we have to have those courageous conversations and listen. Another thing, which is somewhat unconventional, but ensure that young people have a primary care physician. David, why is this important? I'm so glad you asked, right? In urban environments, there's communities in Detroit where, Karen, believe it or not, the PCP, primary care physician ratio, is like 1 in 300 for young people, which means that there's only one primary care physician for every 200, 300, 400 young people. Why does that matter? That matters because it keeps us out of the urgent cares. It keeps us out of the emergency rooms. Not that anything is wrong with that. However, absent a primary care physician, you have no medical record. You have nobody walking through this journey with you to identify these things. When something pipes up, they can actually place it somewhere, Right. So I also think that that is vitally important. So I would say listen for sure. Ensure that young people actually have a primary care physician. As unsexy as that sounds, it actually makes a tremendous difference. Right. And then also be willing to kind of have the courageous conversation and bring to bear unusual suspects and unlikely allies. So as a Black man, I love engaging in these conversations, but I also recognize that many of my peers and my counterparts that may not look like me, they also have a role to play, right, in creating the conditions that are necessary for our young people to thrive.
When 866-801-8255, as our folk are listening, how do you need us to engage with the Steve Fund? What do you want us to know? And then what do you need us to do?
Yeah, so that's a great question. One, if you are working within an education environment, right, whether it's higher education, and that could be a HBCU, a PWI, a HSI, right, a predominantly white institution, Hispanic serving institution, a community college, reach out to the Steve Fund. We have a team of mental health experts across the country, and we would love to work with you in partnership with you to do a couple of things. One, to uplift and highlight the great things that you have already going to promote and protect the mental health of your student body, right? We want to make sure that we can take those lessons learned and share them with others. Two, we have the capability to do a comprehensive needs assessment over a period of 12 to 18 months. We lockstep with you hand in hand and pair you with the mental health expert to identify opportunities to make your campus or your learning environment, I'm sorry, if you aren't on a campus, more attractive to young people of color. Think about it, Karen. If your son or daughter wants to be an engineer, right? There's a list. US News, there are places you can go. What's the best school for engineering, right? Major university, mid-major university. Have we as a nation had a courageous conversation? You know, my child is schizophrenic. Like, what's the best education environment for this young person? My daughter suffers from anxiety and depression. Right. Those are the types of questions. In addition to like, are you Division One, Division Two? In addition to like, how many degrees you actually offer? I want to know. Right. So I think also pushing the narrative in that way. So if you are a higher education institution or an education institution, reach out to the Steve Fund for sure. If you are an individual where you have a family, whether it's yourself or someone in your family, know someone who is struggling with mental health. We also have tools and resources to support the caregivers. Like, reach out to us in that way as well. And then also, like, support our charge, if you will, to enter into spaces that people aren't willing to enter into, to have conversations people aren't willing to have, to like do what you did at the top of this call. Just name it. Name it. Black people in America, especially our young Black people, and then for our Asian American brothers and sisters and our Hispanic brothers and sisters, their experiences, our experiences within these institutions that we've stood up in America are quite different than our white counterparts, right? And we want to make sure that we're changing that narrative and pushing that conversation forward.
Has there been pushback because as DEI is under attack, it's so weird. Anything that looks like equity or
It
inclusion,
is.
it feels like oppression to people. Are you getting pushback, from people saying, "Why just young people of color?"
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that. And me and my peers in the space, even when I was in philanthropy, this was a healthy point of disagreement, right? Largely because just based on my experience, Karen, I was born and raised in Flint, Michigan, right? Flint, Michigan is home, small town. When I was growing up, one of the most dangerous cities in America, right, per capita.
That's what they
So,
told you. It was still Anchorage, Alaska, David. It was still Anchorage. It was always Alaska. Wait,
yeah.
before you go on, do you still have people in Flint?
Most definitely, yeah.
Okay, and is the water still bad? Is the water, we don't talk about it anymore. Is the water still bad in Flint? Can we talk about it? Damn.
We could talk. Look, my wife and I had two children in the middle of the water crisis, right? So the infrastructure, and actually, I think that this speaks to mental health as well, largely because on the surface, I'm so glad you asked this, right? Because on the surface, when people hear mental health, it's easy to think anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. But you and I both know, Karen, like, you and I both know individuals who, if their basic needs would have been met, that would have prevented a whole bunch of mental. So it's not that Jimmy is crazy. No, he was struggling with his rent. Right? Like,
Or he
so
couldn't brush
sometimes.
his teeth and couldn't couldn't wash his ass properly because he was scared of the water.
Yeah, like, you know, like literally, I was in a situation where, like, when you gotta use bottled water to brush your teeth for 8, 9, 10 months, when you gotta get gallons of water, just to, think about all of the things that it takes to use water. And here's the thing: here's what you didn't see on television, right? I lived in Flint during that time, and we still have property in Flint. What you didn't see, think about all of the water-based products in one's home that you don't think about day to day, right? Your air conditioner unit. Your dishwasher, right? Your refrigerator, right? So even if the pipes, the infrastructure was replaced, which we actually did do that, it took longer than it should have, because if this was a, you know, a white suburb, it would have happened a little sooner, some would say. But all of those water-based products created a sense of anxiety for individuals. Oh my goodness, did I mix the baby formula with that water six, seven months ago? Right? So Karen, you may have to think, did I have a speaking event in the Flint area? And did I have to drive through Flint during that period of the water crisis and stop to use the restroom and get it? So people who don't even live here also had to retract their steps and think, did I meet the love of my life and I went to Flint to meet my new in-laws and we stayed for the weekend during the water crisis and didn't know, right? So when you think about all of that pressure and anxiety, so all of that said, when you ask the question around, like, are we getting pushback related to DEI and things of that nature? Not really, largely because the work that we're focused on is really around mental health. And how I like to call it, I like to focus on the disparity, not just the diversity. Nothing wrong with diversity, but I've personally, just taking my Steve Fund hat off for a moment, I've always struggled with diversity, equity, and inclusion. I've always struggled with terms like belonging, and I'll tell you why. Because inclusion in and of itself could indirectly signal that something already exists that you're now going to include me in, right? Belonging indirectly signals that, oh, now I need to belong to something that's outside of myself, right? And then the last thing I'll say is that for a young person of color navigating an urban environment, and this is just David, little old David McGee's perspective, the post-affirmative action decision and the kind of uprising of DEI, Karen, those are issues we've been dealing with. Right. Like, they just may not have been at the forefront.
We didn't have a catchy term for it. Like,
exactly.
CRT. We didn't have acronyms that people could use and then flip it around and gaslight the entire world. Or, you know,
one of the things I will say, though, is like the Supreme Court decision does ensure that the pool of diverse students on campuses will be reduced. Right. Like that is unfortunate. Those student populations will likely become whiter and more Asian and less Black, less Latino, less Indigenous. Right. And the implications of these decisions extend even beyond college admissions. Right.
So let me ask you this. You know, there were some great doctors and lawyers that came up during Jim Crow, even W.E.B. Du Bois, who went to Fisk, and Carter G. Woodson were in the midst of Black History Month. Brilliant minds. George Washington Carver spent his career at Tuskegee. I think about, let them have it. Because here's what I know, David McGee, and we're going to get back to the Steve Fund in a second. But here's what I know, and part of this inclusion, and, oh, I just want to drink from the water fountain that says, you know, that doesn't say colored, or I just want to be at Harvard. I just want to, just let me in your club, in your golf clubs. We're dope as F. The amount of creativity, ingenuity, genius, the multiplicity of things that can be done, not just one thing or another. I could be a scientist and a musician, and guess what? My musical skills inform my science and vice versa. There's no jack of, you know, one thing. It's not one thing that I need to master. I'm mastering everything. Not having us in a university setting, which is where young people develop, which is where community happens, which is where you start to figure out what you're supposed to be doing here, what your purpose is. That's a disservice to everybody on that college campus. And any college president worth his or her salt, their salt, anybody who is a professor, you don't want. I taught at Hunter College for 22 years, the most diverse college, and I taught at NYU for 3. And I got to juxtapose the difference to this day. That they're right now at Sirius XM, at least 16 of my students working, and another dozen at MSNBC and NBC Universal. because the kinds of exchanges that we had in the classroom, and for many of them, I was the first black professor they ever saw. But it was a diverse, and the conversations we had around everything were so much richer. I don't know how you have a university or a college without that kind. Why would you want that? So let them have it. Let them have it.
So my daughter's in the fourth grade, and tomorrow night, Karen, is multicultural night at her school, right? And she's predominantly white school, and she's been talking to her little girlfriends about what to bring to school and all of that. And my wife and I were talking about it last night to the exact point you just made. We were saying, like, we're not going to bring a table. We're not going to bring any food. Maybe we just show up and we just stand there. And when people come to our station, right, we'll just keep repeating, we are the culture. We are the culture.
I love it.
We are the culture, right? Like that's it, right? But to your point, it doesn't come from a place of arrogance. It comes from a place of brilliance, of beauty, of ingenuity, of creativity, of all of those things really point to us being the culture, or at the very least a part of it. So it's not to include us into something that we actually help build, right? It's not to qualify or justify whether or not we belong in a place that we actually built, right? So it'll be interesting. I'll follow up with you and let you know how much.
I'm going to bring you back because I want to know. And I also want to say maybe more of our babies wouldn't feel so depressed and disconnected if that was the narrative, if that was reinforced on a regular basis that they are magic and they are all of the things and they are enough and they don't have to be included because they are the inclusion. They are, they're not the exception. They are the rule. If that can become the narrative that we repeat to them. And then I'm going to ask you why you send your baby to a predominantly white school. I'm just curious. I'm not indicting you, David McGee. I just want to know.
It's all good. So interestingly enough, it's, I don't want to call it an experiment because that will sound like I was too smart when I did it. My daughter's in the fourth grade. My son is in the second. This is their third school, right? So it's also us having an opportunity to understand, to your point, our children are beautiful. They're brilliant. And unfortunately, the education system is designed in such that we'll have to supplement a part of their education anyway, right? So our children have been in a school that was predominantly white, a school district that was predominantly black, and then a school district that was probably the most diverse school district we've experienced right outside of Seattle, Washington, when we lived there. So it's really us having an opportunity to understand which environment will our children respectfully thrive in the most, so we can better prepare them for this world that they'll take on.
That's everything. That's everything. And even as, you know, we're having this conversation, thank you for indulging. You know, it's you go to places, and I know you have to, you know, you're doing these talking points because the Steve Fund needs funding as well, you know, and we need to support it. But I also feel like this kind of engagement helps you do this work even more because you make it real. People connect to people. So we can't just be stats on a paper. So I appreciate you telling us. So tell us about the 8-year-old before I let you go.
Oh, my goodness. So again, we are now, you know, every dinner conversation, every night we have a different conversation around dinner. And we had just came off a cruise with Disney. My kids, you know, they love the Disney cruise. And, you know, I recently visited Montgomery, the Legacy Museum, right?
And is that Brian Stevenson?
Yeah, Brian Stevenson. Phenomenal. And I told my wife, I said, listen, Disney's on pause, right? Like, we're not, for the next few vacations, like, we're learning about we're going to every black museum, you know. So we went to the African Charles H. Wright Museum in Detroit, right? So we live right outside Detroit this past weekend. And this was my 8-year-old boy's first experience into that, right? Like, he's seen it in the neighborhoods, but he hadn't seen it that rich. So he cried halfway through it, right? It was moving. He started asking questions. Why did white people treat us like that? What was this? And then we talked about Black History Month. And Karen, and I'll just be fully transparent with some liberties here. I mean, some risk here. My 8-year-old boy really couldn't register Black History Month. And I felt like I dropped the ball, right? Because it was so top of mind for me that he didn't know February was Black History Month, right? And I said, you don't talk about it at school, Deuce? We call him Deuce. His name is David as well. He said, no. Monday was President's Day. Karen, when I tell you, when he came home from school yesterday, I said, hey, how was school, buddy? He said, well, Dad, I went straight up to my teacher and said, why haven't you reminded everybody that February is Black History Month?
Come on.
I said, did you now?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. And I said, what did she say, buddy? She said, oh, David, I didn't. And he said, Dad, and I told her, I said, no, ma'am, you did not. You did not tell everybody that February was Black History Month. And I said, how did that go? He said, for the rest of the class, their whatever it is that they did, their activity, their book was focused on Black history. Right. So we got to teach the babies. Right.
Yes.
The baby.
Yes. Good job. Good job. Good job. Good job. Parenting is trial and error. Mostly error. But, you know, your job is to, you know, awaken the curiosity and unlock in the DNA of your children all of that greatness that is stored away for thousands of years. That's your job.
It is. We got to plant them shade trees we'll never sit under. That's what we have to do.
I'm so happy that I got to meet you today. I thought this was going to be a perfunctory kind of, you know, you're going to come on. You started with that, though. You started coming on with the perfunctory. I was like, not today, sir. I had a bad day yesterday. You will not be the last guest today coming in with the nonsense.
If it's okay, really, really quick. Yes. The reason I did it is because it's so important, especially for our young Black children, our young children of color, to actually see it. And I'm not pedestaling myself, but to see individuals like you and I being open and real about these conversations, right? So if the other part, my other answer to the question you asked, like what can people do, is figure out where they are on the journey, right? Everybody has a role to play. And I'll tell you, in the public health sector, and I'll make this really quick, there's a parable around babies floating in the river, right? And I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
No.
But the parable goes that there are, you know, two women walking, like they're taking a hike, like they're in the woods. And they come across a river, and Karen, babies are floating, like coming down the river. And they just run over and start pulling the babies out of the river, right? And when they pull one out, they see another one. And they pull, so they start waving, like, come help us. And they're pulling babies out of the river, Karen, until one woman steps back and she walks away. And they say, hey, where are you going? She said, I'm gonna go up and see how the baby's getting in the river in the first place, right? So I think that pulling the babies out of the river, we call that downstream work. Right? Stopping the babies from getting in the river in the first place, we call that upstream work. Right? So my charge to every listener, my charge to every Black person, but then everybody on their journey, is your work upstream work or downstream work? There's a place for you along this river, right? Either you help us get these babies out of the river, or you change policies and practices, right, to stop them from going in the river in the first place. And that's where I think everyone has an opportunity, but not only an opportunity, a responsibility to promote and also protect the mental health and emotional well-being of all people. But what, based on what the data tells us, especially our young people of color.
That was a mic drop. David McGee is his name, the CEO of the Steve Fund, stevefund.org. Go there, donate. I don't know, maybe they'll show up in Urban View Gives. I'm going to talk to him after this. This is so powerful. I appreciate you immensely for the work that you're doing, but also who you are. You showed up today. David McGee, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen. Take care.
Yes, it's the Karen Hunter Show. We'll be right back.